A student of genealogy, Dr. Burl B. Gilpin, Jr., discovered some interesting facts when his studies led him to obtain the genealogy of the Washington family. In that record, he found genealogical confirmation of the migration pattern of the Caucasians. You don't have to take any more calls. The information is taken from a book in the Library of Congress, Washington, D.C., written by Albert Wells, titled Pedigree and History of the Washington Family. This book contains the following information concerning the background of George Washington. Quote, Odin. Now, each of the sons of Jacob got a special promise in that same series of prophecies in Genesis 48 and 49, where the birthright was given to the sons of Joseph and the scepter to Judah. Those promises have God's integrity attached, and the Celtic peoples are thus not just an amorphous mass with no differences. Even though the 10 tribes formed a northern kingdom, they still fought among themselves. And though the Benjamites were a part of the kingdom of Judah, there's a special history attached to the Benjamites. Each one of those promises you can find in the various splinter nations of the Celtic broad group. The dominant tribe was always, so much so that the synonymous name for the 10 tribe kingdom was Ephraim. But the other tribes have a history too. And Manasseh was to become a great nation, as the other descendants had special promises attached. You also find those same tribes receive additional special promises in the Song of Moses. I preach a generic and general message out of the Song of Asher, a promise that's applicable to all of God's children, but there are specific national items in that Song of Asher that apply to the tribe of Asher. I'm saying, without having yet proven it, and we'll get back to it in more detail in the prophecy series on Sunday, that the United States fulfilled the prophecy of the great nation Manasseh. But this is on George Washington. Odin, first king of Scandinavia, B.C. 70, came from Ossaland, or Ossaheim, east of Tanais. He endeared himself to the Asiatic subjects, successful in every combat. Son of Fridulf, supreme ruler of the Scythians in Ossaland, or Ossaheim, Turkestan, between the Euxine and Caspian Seas, in Asia, exactly where the tribes of Israel, the northern kingdom, were resettled by the Assyrians. He reigned in Asgard, whence he removed B.C. 70 and became first king of Scandinavia, died B.C. 50 and was succeeded by sons who ruled in different parts of Scandinavia. Frode Fredegod, fourth generation from Odin, was king of Denmark at the time of Christ and died in A.D. 35. Still reading from the Pedigree and History of the Washington Family. Thorfinn the Dane was the 32nd generation from Odin. He founded the Washington family, born about A.D. 1000. His ancestors came from Schleswig in Denmark and settled in Ebor or Yorkshire prior to the Norman conquest. Colonel John Washington was the 51st generation from Odin. He migrated to America and settled in Virginia. He was the great-grandfather of George Washington. Now, Denmark's just a little point of land jutting out on the northwest coast of Europe. But at one time, it was the master and the largest of the Scandinavian kingdoms. Denmark's simply Dan's mark. Scandinavia. Dan would leave his mark, would judge his people. Dan means to judge. There are no vowels in the Hebrew. It could be Dan, Den, Dun, Don. He left his mark by the characteristic trait that the Bible gives us the clue from. Wherever they moved, they changed the name to their father Dan. Odin having distinguished himself among the Scythians. Where do you think Scythian comes from? Sukkoth. The Feast of Sukkoth. Sukkoth. Tabernacle. Temporary structure. Archaeologists will tell you what the Scythians, what marks a Scythian. Scythians were great archers and great horsemen. That's all that archaeologists and historians, general traditional historians, can agree on about Scythians. They were great archers and great horsemen. Their name means they lived in booths, sukkot. They moved temporary structures. Feast of Tabernacles, you make temporary structures. They were nomads. That's where the name Scott comes from, nomad or wanderer. It has its roots in Sukkoth. In the writings unraveled and translated through the clue of the Behistun Rock that Rawlinson translated, we learn that Scythians and Sakasuni are one and the same. Sakasuni is short for Isaac's sons, was the name that the Persians gave these displaced House of Israel, 10-tribe, so-called lost tribe kingdom. The Assyrians called them Beit Humri or Kumri, after the sixth king who changed the laws and changed the capital and put his mark on the 10-tribe kingdom to such a degree that when they were carried into bondage, the Assyrians called them Beit Kumri, a root for Sumerians, Cimmerians, Kimri, an ancient name of the Welsh. These Scythians or Scythians were none other than these same resettled 10-tribe kingdom people who traveled as marauding bands after they had finished their job as mercenaries with the Medes to break the back of the Assyrians. And Odin became distinguished, a descendant of Fridolf, supreme ruler of the Scythians. I'll read on here. Note that the first paragraph of this record contains a sentence of tremendous historical significance. It states that Odin was the, quote, son of Fridulf, supreme ruler of the Scythians in Ossaland or Ossahan, between the Euxine and Caspian Seas in Asia. This sentence places the family of Washington right in the midst of the migrating Israelites as they moved from Assyria by way of the Caspian Sea, the Caucasus Mountains, and the Black Sea into Europe, where their exploits changed the face of a continent, as the apocryphal book of Esdras referred to in a message two Sundays back. They took counsel among themselves and departed through the headwaters of the river Euphrates, a multitude so great it took them a year and a half. And the headwaters of the Euphrates takes them across the Turkish plateau through the Caucasus Mountains, from whence it gets its name. There is, and has been for many years, the pass that carried in ancient maps the name the Gate of Israel, as they passed through to the north of the Black Sea. This transmigration of the major portion of Israel's clans from the land of their captivity was the greatest mass movement of a multi-tribed kingdom of kindred people in the history of the world. These captive Israelites were once proud citizens of the northern ten-tribed kingdom of Israel. They were a people of prophetic destiny and could not be subdued by their captors. I'm sure it will come out more now with the Iron Curtain broken, but it began to seep out in archaeology over past years. Graves in the southern Crimea and in other areas in the southern plains above the Black Sea, behind the Iron Curtain in past times, they would find graves of people of Israelitish descent who traced their heritage back to the day of their nation's founding, and the date that they trace it back to is the date that Jeroboam broke from Rehoboam and founded the nation Israel. Dr. J. Llewellyn Thomas points out that the kingdom of Judah was not involved in Israel's transition. This migration, he says, took place about a century after their main deportation. Let it be noted that it commenced before the destruction and carrying away of the kingdom of Judah by Nebuchadnezzar. Israel had started on their migration out of the land of their captivity into the southeast of Europe before Judah ceased to exist as a kingdom. Note that when the Jews returned, the main body of the Israelites were in Arsareth, over 1,000 miles from Babylon. This migration, I've already mentioned in the apocryphal books, took place at the time when the great Assyrian Empire was falling before the rising of the New World Empire of Babylon. Not quite accurate. They participated in the breakdown of the Assyrian kingdom with the Medes, who, crushing Assyria, gave the opportunity for Babylon to rise up and seize the space. Israel seized the favorable opportunity of those times of escaping into Europe, third time now, as I've already pointed out, recorded in the book of Esdras and the apocryphal books. One other fact must be mentioned here to keep the record straight. Indeed, it is a point of peculiar import even in these latter days, though generally ignored or forgotten. It is true, as Dr. Thomas says, that the southern kingdom of Judah as a whole was not involved in Israel's deportation, nor in the mass migrations westward which took place in subsequent years. However, there is one brief record concerning Judah which is of supreme importance. It is found in 2 Kings 18, verses 9 to 13, which we quote in part. Quote, "It came to pass in the fourth year of King Hezekiah, which was the seventh year of Hoshea, king of Israel, that Shalmaneser, king of Assyria, came up against Samaria and besieged it. besieged it. And here the Bible is using the new capital established by the sixth king, Humri, as a synonym for the whole nation. But also, the city was the target in this case, as Jerusalem was the stronghold of Judah. Samaria was the stronghold after Umri of Samaria the nation, Ephraim the nation, house of Israel the nation. And at the end of 3 years, they took it, that is the city of Samaria. Even in the sixth year of Hezekiah, that is the ninth year of Hoshea, king of Israel, Samaria was taken, and the king of Assyria did carry away Israel into Assyria. Now in the 14th year of King Hezekiah, did Sennacherib, king of Assyria, come up against all the fenced cities of Judah and took them. And one record has it, more than 200,000 at one time taken into captivity and resettled as the northern kingdom was. By the time the Babylonians took the kingdom of Judah, it was reduced down essentially to the city of Jerusalem, besieged by Nebuchadnezzar. Briefly, the salient facts are these. In the sixth year of Hezekiah's reign, Shalmaneser captured Samaria and deported Israel to Assyria. Then 8 years later, in the 14th year of King Hezekiah, did Sennacherib, king of Assyria, come up against all the fenced cities of Judah and took them. The essential point to note here is that these captives from the fenced cities of Judah, the outlying cities other than Jerusalem, were not taken to Babylon but to Assyria, where they were henceforth identified with their kinsmen of the ten tribe kingdom. Sennacherib was unable to capture Jerusalem at that time because the Lord had other plans for that city and the remaining remnant of Judah. It was over 100 years after these events before the capture of Jerusalem and the deportation of its citizens to Babylon. The key to understanding, to you who just joined us, I'm in the middle of reading something about the background to leaders in America, starting with Albert Wells' book titled Pedigree and History of the Washington Family, George Washington's lineage. It goes back to Odin, first king of Scandinavia. And Odin goes back as son of Fridulf to the days when the children of Israel, northern kingdom, were captives of Assyria. Having broken those chains of bondage, became wandering Scythians. The key to understanding, having talked of the Assyrian conquering not only of Samaria and the northern kingdom, but the fenced cities of Judah, and carrying them into Assyrian bondage, not Babylon bondage. The key to understanding for us lies in the fact that the kingdom of Judah included not only the tribe of Judah, but Benjamites, Levites, and members of the royal house of David. Descendants, as the some 50,000 who came back from Babylonian captivity 70 years after their capture, included Zerubbabel, who was a distant member of David's family. The reigning line was Zedekiah when the city fell. And his daughters were taken by Jeremiah to Spain and Ireland. But there were in the lineage some of David's descendants, the royal line, even in the fenced cities of Judah. Thus, when the Assyrian king captured the fenced cities of Judah, he transported to Assyria not Judahites alone, but portions of Benjamin, portions of Levi, and portions of the house of David. There's reliable evidence also that they were not few in number. Sennacherib's inscription, the secular side of the story, According to AHSA, states that the number of cities taken was 43, and that he took captive 200,150 men of Judah, not counting women and children. This move brought representatives of all the tribes of Jacob Israel into the multitude of Israel assembled in Assyria. These people were not, quote, Jews, have never been so designated in subsequent history. By this means, God assembled representatives from every family of Jacob to participate in the future glory of all Israel. Now, I have been a preacher who has defended the promises to Judah, and the name Jew never occurred until the two kingdoms separated and they were at war, and in the book of Deuteronomy, during that war in which the house of Israel joined with the heathen kingdom was fighting against Judah, for the first time the citizens of the kingdom of Judah are called Jews. That's your first record of the Jewish name, citizens of the southern kingdom of Judah. Have defended the fact that the promises of the scepter to Judah, the promises that were given to those that were restored, particularly the promise that was given to Daniel of his people, the Jew, and his city, Jerusalem, are abundant proof of God's hand on history, and the restoration of the state Israel is a proof of the fulfillment of those promises where he gathers them from their dispersion. My quarrel with the traditional churches, out of fear of being tabbed a British Israelite, which is a cult name, they established legalism. They deny the meaning of the grace of God as preached in Galatians. They're strict legalists. They repractice the Sabbath when the book of Hebrews says that Sabbath keeping changes to the life of faith rather than a particular day in the week. British Israelitism is a cult, a sect with a particular doctrine. They may have a grain of truth in their recognition of the roots of the British people, but the rest of their stuff pushes into a box that is clearly defined with sectarian and cultic meaning. To say that anyone who teaches on these truths is a British Israelite is like saying anyone who preaches water baptism is a member of the sect, the church so dominant in southern states, the Church of Christ. Also very legalist, by the way. I refuse to bow to those epithets and name-callings, and the tragedy is the scholars of the traditional church, out of fear of being so branded, have not paid attention to the research. I come back again and again to this subject matter, even to those that have heard me teach on it, because the weight of tradition is such, you've got to literally beat it out of people's heads. And there are a lot of you watching me that lights were turned on the first time we got on the subject. But you have had to admit, as the months and years have gone on, the firmness of your understanding and your ability to see God's faithfulness in carrying out His Word has come about in the mass of evidence that piece by piece and night after night and year after year has been laid down here on the festival and the multiple teaching on the lost tribes, and in innumerable times of teaching on it. Not one of you have heard me add this little bit of evidence at any time in all of the teaching. But again and again, the evidence lays down the proof that God was dealing with two nations. He called Jeremiah as trustee for two nations. And those that would try to say that that little band of 60,000 who came back from Babylon after 70 years of bondage, with the balance of over 500,000 who refused to respond to God's call and stayed in Babylon, that little 55 who came back and formed the second kingdom, that they allowed to be ruled by an Edomian, head Herod, a descendant of Esau, at the time of Christ, is somehow representative of all the promises of God. Don't know much about history or God's promises. And their claim is solely based upon the fact that as they took stock of their new kingdom in the days of Ezra and Nehemiah, with good intentions, they sought out representatives of all the tribes, and because they would find one family from Manasseh or one family from Ephraim, they would then claim the promises of all 12 tribes. Well, that kind of non sequitur reasoning applied to the northern kingdom would say the little kingdom that came back from Babylon doesn't even qualify as Jews, because there were more of the kingdom of Judah carried into bondage, assimilated with the northern kingdom that moved northward to become the Celtic migrations. There were more of the kingdom of Judah with that group than there were of the kingdom of Israel with the Judah group. And there were more Jews from the Judah group who stayed in Babylon, didn't care enough to come back to Palestine, than there were that came. But God viewed the kingdom of Judah in terms of those who stayed on the track of his promises for Judah, that involved the 490 weeks, that involved the promises given to Daniel. It didn't matter that 600 didn't take advantage of the chance to come back and didn't believe the promises that had been given to Daniel and decide to stay in Babylon and make money. The 50,000, 55,000, ultimately about 60,000, who believed God and acted on his promises, they became the root from which Judah and its promises grew, even today, to the kingdom of Israel, or the nation of Israel. Likewise, when those from Judah assimilated with the northern tribes, they became a part of the nation that carried the promises in successive waves of the birthright people to come to the jumping-off place of the British Isles and Manassas, to leap on over to the Western Hemisphere. Back to this article. We're now ready to mention some of the names by which these people were known during the period of their scattering and colonization. It was prophesied that they would gradually lose their identity and call themselves by other names. I've preached on Hosea chapter 1, you go on into the second chapter, particularly 17th verse, and Isaiah 28:11, they call themselves by other names. They won't be known as God's people. They won't be known any longer as Israelites. Let us note first what names these people bore before their captivity. Among others, we find three in particular: the house of Israel, the house of Isaac, the house of Omri, or Cumri, with a harsh aspirin sound. Dr. William Pascoe Gord states the distinction well by saying that Israel was a divinely given spiritual name. Isaac was the divinely given family name, and Omri was the dynastic or national name in his book, Post-Captivity Names of Israel. Omri, or Cumri, and I always return to the best illustration of the difficulty of taking this phonetic sound that I can't even pronounce properly. It has a cough attached to the vowel when you put the little aspirant reverse apostrophe above the letter. That's the clue to its pronunciation, and you end up with people confusedly writing it down like the Khomeini of Iran, or Khomeini. You'll see his name when the news people first started pronouncing it, and he became suddenly a worldwide figure. The earliest news stories would sometimes spell it Khomeini. Others would spell it Khomeini, because of this harsh sound. In the King James, you'll see Omri, written in English, O-M-R-I. In the original, the harsh aspirant sound would be there for Qumri. Qumri was Israel's most renowned king. Who was David's most renowned? Who was, however, gave it away? Who was Judah's most renowned king? David. Israel here being a reference to the northern kingdom. Who was their most renowned king? I mean, he was right, just the most famous, Qumri. It was he who substituted the statutes of Qumri for the commandments, statutes, and judgments of the Lord. Micah, the prophet to the northern tribes that you don't hear much preaching about, and I haven't gotten to Micah yet, in his sixth chapter refers to their departure from God and his laws by saying, "For the statutes of Qumri are kept, and all the works of the house of Ahab, and ye walk in their counsels. And for this, Micah prophesies, I should make thee a desolation, and the inhabitants thereof an hissing. Therefore ye shall bear the reproach of my people. It was the laws of Qumri and the evil works of Ahab that guided them." His influence in lawmaking, says Dr. Gord, is with us still. Therefore, the people who kept his law were called by his name. In Israel, Beth Qumri, House of Qumri, or in the Assyrian archaeological records, Beit Qumri, Son of Qumri. Whatever other names Israel bore in the days of her residence in Palestine, such as Ephraim, etc., she bore out into captivity these two names, Isaac or Issachar, where you drop the first vowel, and Qumri with the harsh sound, Qumri. During the captivity, Israel acquired other names. All of them are found in many forms with variations on the spelling of the same names. Among the variations of Beth Qumri, 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 Cimmerians, Gimri, and as I've already said, Beit, son of Qumri, Beit Qumri. The name Isaac also had a score or more of variations, such as Sakai, Sakai, Sakasuni, Sakasuna. But the Sakai, too, are called Cimmerians, Gimrians, and Scythians. The fact that is established by the inscription, which are best known and which have furnished the key to Assyriology. The Sakai, who in Latin are called Sakai, were an important branch of the Scythian nation, uncovered, as I've already said, by Professor Rawlison in his translation of the Behistun Rock. Historians agree that the Scythians were one of the greatest military powers of the day. But many of them failed to see how this distinction could be claimed for the northern kingdom of Israel. Yet in the time of Jeroboam, Israel could put 800,000 mighty fighting men in the field, gathered from within its own boundaries, as 2 Chronicles 13:3 declares. A nation able to do that today would be rated a sizable military power. When? Am I boring you? Kind of heavy stuff. Since the days of the Hebrew-Phoenician activity, the thoughts of the Bethsock and their descendants had ever been concentrated upon the Isles of the West. And this imparts no little meaning into the seemingly idle statement in the saga that for Odin, the Northwest was a region where he knew by his skill and magic that a place of refuge was reserved for him and his people. The saga of Odin He was pursuing a destiny of a place that was reserved for him and his people. And that goes back to David in the height of his kingdom, when both nations were united, when the prophet came to David and says to David, "Furthermore, I have prepared a place." They're already in place in the so-called promised land of Israel. David rules from the Euphrates to the Nile. And God comes through the prophet Nathan and says, "I've prepared a place where you won't be bothered by your traditional enemies, those that have been a thorn in your flesh and bothering you, and you won't have to move from that place ever again." Here in the saga of Odin, they moved with a sense of destiny that such a place was prepared for them. I'm boring you. Get on telephone. All right, if you want me to continue, you talk to them. Now, you can finish the calls you're on, but don't take any more. I want to continue this subject. We're on the subject of George Washington's heritage, on the hypothesis that the prophecies to Manassas are fulfilled in the United States. And we have just seen from that little book in the Library of Congress on the pedigree of the George Washington family, he's descendant of Odin, the Scandinavian king. And for further light on this fascinating subject, we turn now to European and Other Race Origins by Herbert Bruce Hannay, Esquire of the Inner Temple, Barrister at Law, Advocate of the High Court of Judicature, Calcutta, and author of A Grammar of the Tibetan Language, quoting Mr. Hannay. Let us now resume the fortunes of the Skolatoi of European Scythia from the time, say, B.C. 92 to 20, when they received into the bosom of their community the Sargean followers of Asha, who had come from Arion and Turon, as already explained, when they adopted from them the name of Asen, when Scythia acquired the new name of Asaland or Asahain, back to the roots of George Washington, being then well up to the north near the confluence of the rivers Pripet and Desna with the Dnieper, and when their capital, now represented by Kiev, modern Kiev, was called Asgard, the place which the apocryphal scripture of Ezra says the ten-tribe kingdom went to as they pierced the Caucasus Mountains north of the Black Sea, the area in and around Kiev, so much in the news because it's part of the Ukraine. It's one of the three founding republics now of the Russian Republic. But the inhabitants who dominate that area are the waves of the Slavs who moved in, pushing the Celts ever westward. But this was the cradle from which the waves of Celtic tribes begin to move westward and northwestward, appearing in exactly the spot, the Celts, that these millions of Israelites disappeared out of Scripture. According to calculations into which I need not enter here, this period is ascertained to have been the approximate time when Odin, or Woden, flourished, chief of the Asen, as we may now call them, and a hero in his own country. He was afterwards deified by the pagan descendants of his subjects, and ultimately his memory was merged in that of the god whose name he bears. Now, you study mythology, Odin's one of the Norse gods. But Odin, the historic person, is here being traced back to Asgard, to his forebears, south of the Caucasus Mountains, south of the Caspian Sea, around Lake Van, the Euxian Sea. The Turkland, where according to the Northern Saga, Odin had great possessions, was like the Svithoidan of the Jotar of Jotland in Scandinavia, merely a reminiscence of Aryan and Turan, that is, Turkestan, the distant home of the Saks during so many centuries. Since the days of the Hebrew-Phoenician activity, says Mr. Hannay, this Calcutta barrister and author of the work European and Other Race Origins, since the days of the Hebrew-Phoenician activity, says Mr. Hannay, quote, the thoughts of the Beth Sak, sons of Saki, house of Saki, and their descendants had ever been concentrated upon the Isles of the West, thus imparting no little meaning into the seemingly idle statement in the saga that for Odin, the Northwest was a region where he knew by his skill in magic that a place of refuge was reserved for him and his people. I decided to go back and fill in the details when I decided to go a bit past the half-hour point, if you want me to continue. Mr. Hannay quotes the following from Crichton and Wheaton. Quote, in the old Swedish legends, it is related that Odin founded the Empire of Svea and built a great temple at a spot called Sigtuna near Lake Mälar in the present province of Uppland, which was known to the Northmen under the name of the Lesser Svithoid to distinguish it from the Greater Svithoid, or Scuthia, from which they believed he had led his followers. When Odin arrived with his 12 pontiffs, or chief priests, you want me to continue? Well, we're tracing the genealogy of George Washington, which the book said, what's the importance of that? Well, he's recognized the founder of this country. Book in the Library of Congress dated, written by Albert Wells, titled Pedigree and History of the Washington Family, says Odin, first king of Scandinavia, B.C. 70, came from Asaland or Asaheim, east of Tanais. He endeared himself to the Asiatic subjects, successful in every combat, son of Fridulf, supreme ruler of the Scythians, in Asaland, or Asaheim, Turkestan, between the Euxine and Caspian Seas, or the Euxine and Caspian Seas in Asia. He reigned at Asgard. To skip along, Colonel John Washington was the 51st generation, I read earlier the paragraphs in between, from Odin. He migrated to America and settled in Virginia. He was the great-grandfather of George Washington. Significance, I'm saying that the United States fulfills the prophecy of Isaiah, where that mountain kingdom to which the tender twig was sent has one of the vines go over the wall, which is none other than the American Revolution, that then created the breakup of the empire into the Commonwealth, because the other sons said there's not enough space for us. We want to leave too, and they dispersed through the colonial empire. All that is fulfilling the prophecies of the northern tribe that in the sons of Joseph, particularly Ephraim, received the birthright promise, as well as the other promises given to the other sons through Jacob and through Moses. Now, I think it's just a piece of evidence, like so many we've laid down, but an important piece of evidence, that George Washington, the so-called father of our country, his lineage goes back some 52 or 53 generations to Odin. I'm reading about Odin. When Odin arrived with his 12 pontiffs, or chief priests, called Diar or Drotnar, he is said to have found that a great part of the land was occupied by a people who, like himself, because these people came in successive waves, had come from Swithoid, but in such long ages past, which had just been identified earlier as the area north of the Black Sea, the land was occupied by a people who, like himself, had come from Swithoid, but in such long ages past that according to their own account, no one could fix the time. These people, who called themselves Gota or Gauta, Goths, were so strong that Odin was forced to make a compact with their king, Gilf, before he could settle the land. One of the greatest of these Scythian expeditions was that under the leadership of the historic Odin, who was subsequently deified. See the Historian's History of the World, Volume 16, pages 18 to 19. Odin amassed a huge army at Asgard in the heart of the Thysagetti and marched first up the valley of the Dnieper, then westward to the shores of the Baltic, and finally crossed to Scandinavia, where he founded a new empire. From the writings of Strabo, Pliny, Tacitus, Ptolemy and others, it appears that the advance guard of Israel was by 58 BC occupying the countries in northwest Europe bordering the North Sea. There they remained, developing their powers and their character till the movements to Britain began. We return now to Odin in relation to the Washington family. Odin is registered in the Washington genealogy as the first king of Scandinavia, B.C. 70. No doubt his forebears were distinguished leaders of clans during their westward trek. It seems likely that there was an Odin dynasty, both before and after the time, of Odin, first king of Scandinavia. The genealogy states that Odin was succeeded by sons who ruled in different parts of Scandinavia. In his book, The Royal House of Britain, An Enduring Dynasty, the Reverend W. M. H. Milner quotes from a leaflet by Mr. Grimaldi in which it was stated, quote, "The descent of our royal family from the royal line of Judah is, however, only a rediscovery." The British research is only a rediscovery. The Saxon kings traced themselves back to Odin, who was traced back to his descent from David. And this may be seen in a very ancient manuscript in the Heralds' College, London. Desiring to verify this, Mr. Milner wrote to Heralds' College and received the positive assurance, May 2, 1901, that, quote, "There is a very valuable manuscript here, deducing our Saxon kings through David. This manuscript," says Mr. Milner, "we have inspected. It is called on the back of the binding, Pedigree of the Saxon Kings. Both Odin and David are listed there," he says. Then on page 41, Mr. Milner traces the later Odin dynasty as follows. "King Edward VII, quoting, "introduced to the throne a new section of the one continuous royal house of Britain. His mother was queen in her own right of the Guelphic line. His father was a prince of the Saxon dukedom of Coburg Gotha, one of the several branches of the house of Wettin. To that house our king belongs. Like the older Saxon and Norman lines, this newer Saxon comes from Odin, whose connection with the dynasty of David we have already discussed. Through one of the sons of Odin and Freya, his wife, were ancestors of Cadwalder, Roderick, and Howell the Good, whence came the Tudor kings of England. and through Nesta and Phliance, the stewards, as well. A second son of Odin made him progenitor of William the Conqueror. Through a third, he was the forefather of Egbert, the first king of England, and of Alfred the Great. Through the union of several lines, he was the ancestor of the Plantagenet kings and the Hanoverian princes. By a fourth son named Vecta, crowned by him king of Saxony, died A.D. 300, Odin was the ancestor of Hengist, last of the kings and first of the dukes of Saxony. Queen Victoria was also of this line by her mother. I'm not going to do you any good to call right now because I'm not going to answer the phone, but if you'll come over here real quickly, I tell you that this genealogy chart that we periodically give away on a live festival, I pick times late at night so that only those that care enough to stay up get a chance. This, the illustrious lineage of the Royal House of Britain, over here where my pencil is. There you go. Is by this, is printed up by this same M.H. Milner. But it's a copy of the royal lineage of the Royal House of Britain. And there, they have a full department that keeps genealogies. Now, many times we've traced from Judah, follow the pencil point, from Judah through the sons of Zara. Zara and his sons, Ethan, Mahal, to Dardanus or Darda. The founder of Troy and the descendants of the Trojans, through Aeneas. We have followed another son of Judah, Chalcol, or Chalcol. We have followed the lines down to Jeremiah, not to Jeremiah himself, but where the father of the High King of Ireland is wed to Tiatephi, the daughter of Zedekiah, brought by Jeremiah to wed with the High King of Ireland. I'm doing this because this is official Royal House of Britain genealogy, available for many years that nobody takes the trouble to look at or find any connections to. If you go back to Darda, son of Zara, you'll trace him from Troy through Aeneas to Brutus, who founded Britain in the Chronicles of Britain. You'll trace the line of Hector through the house of Troy and another line. Now through Priam of the Dardanus line, Priam's daughter is traced. You take the number 2, which identifies with Priam, go over to this other 2, and you will go to Priam's daughter, tracing her lineage. Let me get this where the camera can pick it up. Get over to my right shoulder. Where are you? Get on my right shoulder. Priam's daughter. Try to get it in focus. You follow that line. You'll go all the way down here. You'll come to Odin, son of Fridulf, as we've already seen, married to Freya. And here's the line of the Norse kings, who through the Normans and the Saxons get connected, as just read, to the British kings, all the way down to the current, go to where my pencil is, to the current line from Queen Elizabeth, George VI, to Queen Elizabeth II. And the phrase, David shall never want a man to sit upon the house of Israel, from Jeremiah. Programs and papers prepared and distributed in 1932 by the United States George Washington Bicentennial Commission. You can go where you want now, Louis. contained the following information on Washington's family name and ancestry. Quote, I'm born here. We've never done this before, have we? I've only scratched the surface. For 800 years, through successive generations, the name of Washington, or de Wessington, has been known for the valor, chivalry, high code of honor, and military distinction of those who bore it. Knights and noblemen of the old world and citizens of the new, each in their own turn, through service and achievement, have given to it a notable place in history. In the process of evolution, this name, like many others known to fame, has had many variations from the modern spelling. It is apparently of Saxon origin and is known to have existed in the 12th century. Early records refer to the village of Wharton in Lancashire and of Wessington in the Palatine Durham. It was from this latter village that the name of de Wessington was derived by the progenitor of the Washington family. In different sections, the name was spelled in divers ways. Other forms appearing in important records are Washington, Washington, and Washington. In the standardized form of the present day, this name is widely mentioned in early county records of England and is engraved on time-worn monuments in churches and cathedrals. George Washington was great to a great extent because of what his ancestors were before him. His great-grandfather, John Washington, came to these shores about the middle of the 17th century and settled in Westmoreland County, Virginia, on the very plantation where in later years George Washington was born. No sooner did the head and shoulders of George Washington rise above the great and near-great about him than his contemporaries across the sea commenced to ask, who is this Superman who has defied our sovereign and wrested our American possessions from our grasp? From which branch of our Washingtons is he descended? So the queries were set afoot, and since that time, many genealogists have devoted much study and research to the subject. Many years were consumed in searching for documentary evidence that would establish the English pedigree of John Washington and of his great-grandson who had risen from the ranks to the head of a new nation. Elusive clues were followed without definitive results until, through the persistent efforts of Henry F. Waters, the connecting links between the American and the English ancestry were eventually discovered. Having established the connecting link, it was then possible to trace the English ancestry of George Washington back through the rector of Purley to the Sulgrave branch of the family and on back for seven generations to John Washington of Twitfield County, Lancashire, whose great-grandson, Lawrence Washington of the Gray's Inn, was mayor of Northampton and grantee of the Sulgrave estate, which remained in the direct family for two generations. Robert Washington inherited Sulgrave Manor. Lawrence Washington, rector of Purley, was next in line. His mother, Margaret Butler Washington, was a daughter of Margaret Sutton, through whom a strain of royal blood descended into the veins of George Washington. Though fitted in every way to serve as a wise and considerate sovereign, had he permitted the people to proclaim him King of the United States of America, he most emphatically declined that honor, preferring to be called the President. Now, a few words about Washington's mother, whose maiden name was Mary Ball. She, too, came from a distinguished family. The escutcheon of her family bears upon it a black lion on a silver shield with a crest, having a lion rampant, holding a golden ball in his paws. The motto in Latin means, and look to heaven. The more immediate ancestry of Mary Ball is traced back to Colonel William Ball, who immigrated to Virginia about 1650, and settled in Lancaster County on a plantation called Millenbeck, on the Rappahannock River. The Bicentennial Papers pay this tribute to Mary Ball. Through his maternal ancestor, there came to George Washington the strength of a philosopher and the truthfulness of a Christian. He was taught to love God supremely. His kind tenderly and to be a good and generous to all living creatures. And above all, he was always considerate of his mother's wishes and ever addressed her as honored madam, thus paying a courtly tribute to her and through her to her distinguished forebears. In an article by George C. Crux in January 1937, there is the following statement. Over the entrance of the House of Tudor, Sulgrave Manor in Northamptonshire, England, hangs the Tudor coat of iron, arms, a replica of which was among the Washington heirlooms. In this coat of arms is to be found both the stars and the stripes. As we've seen, many of the early colonists wanted to crown George Washington King of the Confederation. He declined the honor. Nevertheless, their readiness to make him king indicates the recognition of his royal lineage. Some of the founding fathers and many other citizens of that time had distinctive family heraldry. However, they said little about their background because of their desire to avoid the rise of class consciousness in the new republic. Yet these facts are extremely important today because they show the common heritage between the English-speaking and kindred peoples. The interesting, though generally unknown, facts which follow are found in the Huguenot Society of Pennsylvania publication, volume 12, page 7. The early colony of Virginia numbered among its prominent leaders at least 20 whose ancestors stemmed from the same royal lines as those of Queen Elizabeth II. In fact, her progenitors gave to America some of our most eminent patriots, including the beloved father of our country, General George Washington. Others among the Queen's American cousins are a vice president, 3 cabinet officers, 8 senators, Chief Justice John Marshall, 6 governors of states, including Patrick Henry and General Thomas Nelson, wartime governor of Virginia and a signer of the Declaration of Independence, Meriwether Lewis, the explorer of Lewis and Clark, General Light Horse Harry Lee of the Revolution, and his still more famous son, General Robert E. Lee, and a veritable host of men and women prominent in national life. Symbolic dreams and prophetic visions from time immemorial have been given credence, notably in the period covered by the Holy Scriptures. According to tradition, the mother of George Washington saw in a dream, when he was but a child, the measure of his future greatness. Another tradition states that an aged Indian chieftain pronounced a divine inspiration when he said of George Washington, quote, "There is something bids me speak in the voice of prophecy. Listen. The Great Spirit protects that man and guides his destinies. He will become the chief of nations, and a people yet unborn will hail him as the founder of a mighty empire." From Bicentennial Papers. Isaac David Odin Washington. Such men under God, this writer says, have produced the miracle of our Saxon heritage. To those who take the trouble to look, there is evidence abounding of the connections of this people that are part of God's destiny prophesied in the promises given to the birthright nation. To ignore it is to ignore perhaps the richest illustration of God's ability to carry out his word found in history flowing from Scripture. And that's why we teach it.